Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome to ASA Central Line. I'm Adam Stryker, here with Dr. Miriam Trajari, Professor and Vice Chair of Clinical Research in the Department of Anesthesiology at Yale University. Welcome to the show, Dr. Trajari.
Thank you for having me here today and for the opportunity to share my research work with you. I also would like to acknowledge our colleagues in medicine and science in general today for their efforts and dedication during this critical time in our fight against the COVID-19, both in the US and worldwide. And so I believe in the importance of research now more than ever, and I appreciate taking the time this time.
Absolutely. Well said. I couldn't agree more. We wanted to talk to you today about your research, your career, and importantly, about your role as a mentor to others. We're looking forward to learning about life as a physician scientist. So to kick things off, let's tell our listeners a little more about you and your work. Can you tell us what you're investigating now?
Briefly about myself, I'm originally from Italy, and I trained in anesthesiology and critical care medicine in Geneva, Switzerland. And then I trained in epidemiology at the University of Washington in Seattle. I stayed at the University of Washington after completing my training and joined the faculty in the early 2000 under the direction of Dr. Fred Cheney, a longstanding chair of anesthesia at the time. And there I started developing my first research program. And later I was recruited to Portland in Oregon under the leadership of Dr. Jeffrey Kirsch, an absolutely outstanding and beloved chair. And then more recently I joined the faculty at Yale University under the direction of another outstanding leader, Dr. Roberta Hines. And here my goal is to continue and strengthen the clinical research program at Yale. So my research focus is primarily on perioperative outcomes. Currently, we are conducting two large clinical trials that both involve critically ill patients. So the first study is a multi-center trial at 10 sites in the country and investigates resuscitation endpoints in patients with acute spinal cord injury. The rationale for this trial is that the guidelines regarding blood pressure management are based on very weak evidence. And currently, these guidelines recommend blood pressure augmentation to higher targets than those that are conventionally used for ICU patients. So in this trial, we want to determine if an augmented blood pressure target is superior to a conventional blood pressure target that would be used in the general ICU population. And we want to know if the augmented target improved long-term neurological outcomes and specifically functional recovery. This project is funded by the Department of Defense under a particular program that's called Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. The other study is a single center trial, but it's still a very large trial that will enroll over 1,000 patients. And it's a complex study because it's conducted under exception from informed consent. It's an ethics study. And so this is a specific situation of emergency research where there is a narrow therapeutic window to start an intervention, like could be an emergency intubation or a cardiac arrest. So there is no time to ask for consent. In this situation, the FDA allows the study procedure to begin before obtaining informed consent. However, there are several rigorous regulatory requirements that need to be met to conduct this type of research. So in this trial specifically, we are randomly assigning participants to be intubated with different ventricle tubes during emergency intubation, either in the emergency department or in the ICU or in the hospital, and they will receive two different types of endotracheal tubes. One is a standard tube, and one is a special tube that is designed to prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia. And so the specifics are that it has a polyurethane cuff and a side port for aspiration of cyclotic secretions. So we'll monitor the patients in the ICU for ventilator-associated events, and then we evaluate the patient 6 months after the intervention to determine if their outcomes are different. Specifically, we're doing an airway evaluation, and then we're recording and documenting the quality of life and cognitive function in these patients. So this trial is funded by the NIH and specifically by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, so NHLBI.
That's fascinating. And two studies that I know are quite valuable as contributions to the field, things that we all do in all our practices each and every day. So excited to see how those turn out. But I'm curious, why did you pursue perioperative research specifically?
Thank you for asking this question, Dr. Stryker. So my training is in anesthesiology and critical care medicine, and therefore perioperative medicine and perioperative research aligns with my interests and with my expertise. And ultimately, my research efforts are about improving patient care, improving patient outcomes in the perioperative period, and contributing. My intent is to contribute with something that makes a real difference in the care of patients that we treat every day. And therefore, this way, I feel the impact of my research extends well beyond the individual patient I can personally see. And so I can achieve a larger goal of improving patient care for many more patients than the one I can actually can care for.
When did you know research interested you? For instance, while in medical school, were you exposed to the idea of a career in research?
Yes, I knew really early in medical school that I was attracted and fascinated by research. And this emerged for me from the understanding that there were many topics where there was not a single answer to certain problems. And so it was often unclear to me which one would be the best approach that would most benefit the patient and also would protect the patient from harm. And so my first experience and exposure to research as a medical student was in my last year of medical school. I was an exchange student in Europe, and I completed my last year in actually Scotland, in Dundee at Nineswell Hospital. And that's where I conducted my first research project and where I really felt excitement. And I was really energized about research and discovery. At that time, my first mentor was now a good friend too, Dr. Chim Lang, who was helping me conducting this project and allow me to present the project in Paris and then help me writing the manuscript that was successfully published. And that really helped me getting really excited about a career in research. And later, when I was an anesthesia resident, I was in the equivalent of a scholar program. So I did an extra year during the residency that was dedicated to conduct research work. And so during that time, I really conducted one of my first studies. And I remember this work being heavily criticized by the reviewers because of weaknesses in the study design. And so at that point, it was still early in my career, I realized that to become a solid researcher, I needed more rigorous training. And that is what really prompted me later on to search for formal training and brought me to University of Washington in Seattle, which had a highly regarded institution for public health. And they had excellent faculty for me to receive really strong training. And so at University of Washington, I earned a Master in Public Health and later a PhD in Epidemiology under the direction of my mentor, Noel Weiss. And I was really fortunate to be able to work with him because he's an excellent methodological thinker and an exceptional mentor. And so I was able to develop and learn research methods formally, and I learned how to design study, how to carefully and properly analyze and interpret data, and also how to become good skills of technical writing, so how to write grants, how to write manuscripts. And so the training was very rigorous with Dr. Weiss' guidance. And also, I was very fortunate to be able to be exposed to outstanding faculty in the Department of Biostatistics there. And it was really, I was really thrilled when I was in a class with Thomas Fleming learning about clinical trial design. And for example, learning about the O'Brien Fleming stopping rules for clinical trial, or learning from Norm Breslow longitudinal data analysis and learning about the Breslow estimator. So it was really exciting to learn methods from the very people that invented them. And so I was really, fortunate to receive outstanding training and having this amazing experience.
What resources have been the most valuable to you in becoming a successful physician scientist?
So I would say that my immediate supervisor had been by far my greatest resource, along with, a good dose of self-determination. So my mentors were really invaluable in my early career at University of Geneva. And I want to name Dr. Peter Suter and Jacques-André Raymond. They really encouraged me to travel to the U.S. to train and strengthen my skills. Subsequently, along my path, I met Dr. Fred Cheney, Jeff Kirsch, Roberta Hines, who provided me with really that balanced mix of clinical duties and protected time to be able to develop the research program that I, was working on, and also mentor junior faculty. And so I think for emerging research scientists, it takes hard work, self-determination, being resourceful, and also have an inquisitive attitude and a lot of dedication to learn new areas in depth. And that can take up a lot of nights, weekends, and vacation time to achieve. I do have a few stories about this, but one that I fondly remember when I was I was leaving for a planned vacation to Bali while a grand deadline was looming for my spinal cord injury trial. And so I had planned on finishing the work from, a room with a view of the villa we were renting with actually my initial mentor from Scotland, Dr. Shim Lang, and his family. But on the way there, there was a volcanic eruption in Indonesia, and we were stranded in Singapore airport for a couple of days. And then later, our flight to Bali was diverted to Jakarta. And so as the deadline is fast approaching, I remember finishing the submission after borrowing an adapter from a passenger and standing next to a column with the only plug in the airport. So we were able to submit just in time. And while I would have preferred avoiding the stress of this last minute situation, I was really thrilled when I learned later that the application was funded. So I would say that it's important that for research scientists that embark on their careers to prepare to be resilient. Because there are going to be bumps in the road and unexpected issues and problems, but you should not be discouraged easily from those. And so I have been fortunate to work with very talented people in the past and currently. And I found it even more the exception that a grant is funded on the first submission or a manuscript is accepted without rejection or needing revision. And so while it's really tough to be rejected, there is a lot of important lessons to learn from the reviewers. And so these are actually great opportunities to improve and become better.
I used to think that struggling for an outlet on a deadline was mainly only something for journalists. That's one thing I hadn't really thought of for a researcher. Mm-hmm. I don't think a lot of us appreciate just what kind of pressure you're on when you're trying to submit these things.
Yes. There is definitely a lot of moments. You feel like you're on call all the time when a deadline is getting closer, for sure.
Well, one thing I'm always fascinated with when it comes to any physician, I should say, but especially physician scientists, but mentors and the role they played in your career path. Talk a little bit about, did mentors play a role and how so in your specific career path?
Oh, definitely. I think I can emphasize more how my mentors have been enormously influential in my career. And I've been incredibly fortunate and really blessed to have had the opportunity to learn from truly exceptionally dedicated and talented and hardworking role models. I've learned very, very much. And what's important is that they not only taught me about research, but I learned about leadership skills, life lessons, and, many other things that go well beyond just the research itself. So initially, at least for my early career, my mentors helped me guide to find resources and opportunity. And I would probably never achieve what I have done without the help and guidance. I can also later in my career, I can give you other example. For example, a story I recall also related to a grant deadline. I was working very intensively on a grant. The deadline was fast approaching and I had clinical duties in the OR. And so I was busy in the OR taking care of patients and I didn't have really a lot of time to work on the grant. And at the time, you know, Dr. Kerr, she was my chair. He came in my room and say, I'll take over your cases so you can focus on your grant and finish it up. And the grant was funded. So, you know, the people like this and the support and the working as a team is really what makes you successful. And receiving support from others is really very, very important. So to me, mentors have been much more than just colleagues advising me on, you know, how to advance my career. They really have been lifetime mentors and great friends to date. And so I do have developed a strong relationship with my mentors and consider this to be a very special gift. It's been very enriching personally, and I wish for everyone to have this experience as well.
Absolutely. It's so important not only to have mentors, but act as mentors as well. Is there specific advice that you've taken away from your mentors or some degree of wisdom that has been passed on to you that you hold dear?
I have lots of stories, but I would say that in early career, probably the mentors are more influential than for me particularly. So my mentors from Switzerland have really changed my life. So they had insisted on the importance of training in the U.S., for example, and they told me they wanted to keep me on the faculty on the University of Geneva when I finished my fellowship. And they said, you know, for you to stay on the faculty, you need to leave, go in the U.S., learn something that you don't know or that we didn't teach you, and then bring it back. And they made themselves as example, like they both train in the U.S., one in UCSF and my other mentor in Pittsburgh. And so they really stressed the importance of having an open mind and on things outside your narrow vision. And so originally, I think I was a little naive thinking that I already learned enough and I had at the time. But thanks to my mentor, they convinced me that I needed to broaden my knowledge even more. And so that's what brought me here to the U.S. And initially, I had the goal of acquiring knowledge training, return to Geneva 2 years later. And then those 2 years were 20 years ago. And so I ended up staying in the U.S. For the rest of my career. So I felt like... I wanted to be grateful to my mentor as well. So when I decided to stay in the U.S., I did try to bring my knowledge back by running my trials in Geneva so others could learn what I had learned. So I do want to emphasize also that I've been particularly lucky to have had exceptional mentors all along my career. So from the early times in Geneva, but also when I... start developing my career in the U.S. Again, I mentioned during my PhD training, I had this stellar mentor, Dr. Noel Weiss, and I was very fortunate he accepted me as a mentee. And he's a person with a great mind from whom I really wanted to learn how to think. And later in my career, you know, Dr. Jeffrey Kirsch and Roberta Hines have been really phenomenal mentors and advisor in many areas for me as well.
What advice would you give to someone thinking about a career in anesthesia research?
Okay, so my first advice, given that we're talking about mentors, is to explore and seek out great mentors and really establish strong relationship with them. So it's a relationship that is very important. There need to be some mutual understanding and interest in the mentor advances the career of the mentee, and the mentee contribute to in some ways to the knowledge and the program of the mentor. But my stronger also advice on a personal characteristics is to persevere. I find that there are, you know, there is great satisfaction when projects are successful or you see the impact of your work on practice change and improvement of care. But there are also a lot of tough moments and frustration before you get there. And so it's important to stay focused on the overall objective. Don't get discouraged by unexpected challenges. And so it helps to keep an open mind, trying to avoid missing the forest for the trees. And sometimes you'll find that there are many solutions to a single problem.
So you mentioned the transition from mentee to mentor. Tell us a little bit about your experience with mentoring younger scholars. What kind of advice do you give them? What kind of wisdom do you like to impart?
Sure, of course. And thank you for asking this question. So one advice that I often give to my mentees is it goes along the line of perseverance. So one important thing I always tell them, I personally always finish what I started, and I make sure that my mentees do that too. I do want them to, if they start embarking something, that they bring their, you know, work to their end. So now for me, I enjoy using my knowledge and my experience to guide mentees along their path and trying to teach them things to avoid, especially, you know, I don't want younger investigators to repeat errors that they've done in the past. So for junior investigator, I think obtaining initial funding is a challenging phase because new investigators need to prove themselves, and success with early funding can determine their future career path. So there is an important selection process that takes place at the beginning stages. So I think helping junior investigator is where I feel mentorship has the biggest role and the biggest influence on the future career. So one of the, there are many mechanisms to advance career or to start an early career. And I wanted to mention the FAIR program, which is a really a strong program to allow early developing clinician scientists to get started toward establishing longer term programs that are more substantial and typically federally funded.
I'm glad you brought FAIR up, but before we go any further, can you just clarify for those of our listeners who may not be as familiar what FAIR is, what it stands for, and what its mission is?
Sure. So FAIR is the Foundation for Anesthesia Education and Research. It provides funding opportunities which are specifically dedicated to members of the anesthesiology community. And so these are crucial mechanisms to support investigators within our own specialty. So FAIR support is critical for a wide range of candidates with different levels of training, ranging from medical students to junior faculty. So medical students, for example, don't always know much about anesthesiologists because they're exposed to many other specialties during their training. And so this program helped bringing highly invested people into the specialty. So I feel like it's a great screening mechanism for selecting and directing strong medical students to our specialty. The program also targets or helps support residents and fellow to have protected time or supported time for an extra year to do additional research, so like a scholar program. And lastly, junior investigator also can benefit, and this is probably the target population, so to speak, that is the most important to target, because obtaining support to launch a research career is challenging in the early stages, especially for anesthesiologists due to the structure and scope of our profession, where it's very easy to get distracted and taken away with other priorities.
Well, let's talk about grants. Is there anything you wish you had known before diving into the grant application process? What's your best advice?
Well, one piece of wisdom I learned maybe later than I should have is that it's important to ensure that research goals align with the priorities of the funding agency. For example, let's assume that an investigator has a question with a hypothesis to test, and the investigative team believes that the question is important. I think it's also critical to know what the sponsor priorities are And then when the study questions or goals align with the funding institution priorities, this is really a key to success. And so I found funding to be mostly successful when those priorities are aligned. The other advice I have is that the way you tell a story and present your work really matters. And so the way you present the application need to be clear, linear, precise. So I strongly discourage rushing because it's hard to do high quality work without giving adequate time. It takes time to plan and design a study. It takes time to write with accuracy. So my recommendation is just, you know, slow down, take the times and do it right. And just trying to present your work as perfect as it can be.
Well, let's delve into the specific types of grants that are available through FAIR. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Sure. And there are several, and I would say ever-expanding opportunity within FAIR. And so I will start talking about the mentor research grants because we these are the ones that are of interest to junior faculty. And these are great opportunity for them if they want to embark in a research career because this mechanism not only support the research project, but importantly support that non-clinical time to work on the project and to learn the skills that will be relevant to their career path. So in some ways, allow the departments to provide the junior investigators protected time to work on their projects and the skills that they need to develop for their careers. Another interesting mechanism is the Transition to Independence Grant. And this is really a sort of a bridging fund for the time between the end of the FAIR grant and the achievement of securing of funding from a federal agency. And so if an investigator that completed FAIR as a grant that has been scored but didn't reach the pay line for funding, it can receive this bridge funding and allowing them to perfect their application, you know, collect more preliminary data or put the application in a position that will be successful for funding. I also wanted to highlight the fact that FAIR is partnering with other societies to enlarge their portfolio. And for example, very recently, there was a grant deadline for the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundations for grants oriented toward patient safety. Also, FAIR is partnering with the National Institute of Health, for example, the GEMSTAR program. Also, it's a matching fund with the National Institute of Aging. And then also with the ABA for grants that are more oriented toward education. So education grants are more focused on education. And also, they're also available not just to junior investigator, but also to senior faculty. So there is a little bit a broader target for that particular grant. And then, as we mentioned earlier, there is a research fellowship grant for residents and fellow that can receive an extra year of training in research and being funded for that. And finally, the medical student grants that we also already mentioned that allow summer research project and early exposure to anesthesia research with a wide variety of opportunity. And I had a lot of students over the years and found that this program is very successful. The students are very highly motivated and in just a few weeks can achieve and complete, a self-limited project. So it's a really, really nice program.
Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit about your daily life. What was the most surprising or unexpected thing you learned or found about your day-to-day role that you currently have?
So I've learned that everything takes longer than you expect. So clinical trials take years before you see the results. So there's always challenges and anticipated issue as you implement project. And so, again, I go back to the concept that it takes perseverance and determination to achieve your goals. And it really helps going through challenges by focusing on long-term goals and important reasons that drive you forward. And again, so it's really important to work by the principle that you need to finish what you started. is a commitment to yourself, is a commitment to the funding agency, and is commitment to your patients. Because, you know, this is the benefit that the patient receive. If we can improve care, or if we can improve their outcomes. So I think with this objective in mind, it's easier to overcome any challenges.
Has being a physician scientist in anesthesiology met your expectations?
Absolutely. So I've been very lucky to achieve what I dreamt for my career, and I do love what I do. As I mentioned earlier, as a junior resident, I wrote my first article. It was an important study about nitric oxide. This was in the mid-90s, where we were describing the fixed exposure in humans of nitric oxide in patients with acute respiratory distress syndrome. And so we knew it was an important study, but it required a lot of iteration before it was published, but eventually it was published in Anesthesiology. So the process was challenging, and again, I realized I could not address certain concern because you cannot rescue a poorly designed study after the study is done. And so it was an eye-opening experience in making me understand that I needed to learn how to design a study correctly. And so that's what really pushed me and prompted to pursue more formal study and put me in the current career path. And now I feel like I can pass along my knowledge and my lesson learned to those I mentor. And so also I have the opportunity to use my own skills for the funding and the work I want to do. So there is a lot of investment in the early stages. But for everyone that starts, for me in particular, I knew I had a goal and I was clear where I wanted to go. I just needed to find the right way to get there. And so with my mentors, I was very lucky to be given the opportunity. And now my hope is to be that mentor for my mentees.
Well, this has been a really great talk. Fascinating to get some insight into your daily life and where you started and what got you interested into your research. But before I let you go, I wonder if there's anything you'd like our listeners to know, anything we haven't touched on yet.
Yes, I would like to mention a couple of more things. So we spoke about grant and clinician scientists, but I do want to say that there are several ways to do research, for example, in an academic setting. So not all influential research is funded by large grants, and every single anesthesiologist or clinicians can contribute to advanced knowledge in our field. And so smaller projects can make big contributions, and there are many ways to contribute to research. And so my message is that I would like to encourage everyone to be part of a research team. And finally, for my last point, I mentioned earlier that doing research requires hard work and takes time. I mentioned this not to intimidate younger investigators, but to advise them that when you consider research areas, it's important to have a passion for it. It's far easier to spend time working on something that inspires you than working on something that you don't have much interest in.
Well said. That's a great place to leave it. Dr. Chajari, thank you so much for your time, for your insight, the stories, and really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us on ASA Central Line.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. This is Adam Stryker, and we will see you next time on Central Line. Take care.
Don't miss the latest issue of the journal Anesthesiology, filled with the latest discovery, knowledge, and insights. Available now at anesthesiology.org. Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts, or visit ASAHQ.org/podcasts for more.